What you're describing in the process of reading is what I'm aspiring to, which is a kind of a deep emotional dialogue, both in the book with the reader, but also in my work with the patient. So I'm more concerned with the experiential nature of our work and what it means to be with someone and the kinds of experiences that follow from a certain way of being with someone than a focus on transference and transference interpretation. Not that I think those aspects of our work are unimportant, but I feel like what is foundational in even making transference interpretations is being tuned into the kind of shared emotional space and process.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Henry Markman. Dr. Markman has published in 2022 a book entitled Creative Engagement in Psychoanalytic Practice. And our conversation today revolves around his search for authenticity and presence in the psychoanalytic encounter. And as you might imagine, those are rich and engaging topics that we spend a great deal of time on. We discuss what they mean, how authenticity shows up in the office, how important is the analyst's personal presence in contrast to what the patient brings to the encounter. These are not binary issues, but we go back and forth about it and have a very thought-provoking conversation. We discuss intersubjectivity, sincerity, analytic symmetry, what it means to surrender in the analytic moment. He discusses cases with us that demonstrate that, and he tells us a little bit about his own personal history. Professionally, Dr. Markman is a training and supervising analyst at the San Francisco Center for Psychoanalysis, and he's the co-chair of Dialogues in Contemporary Psychoanalysis at the Psychoanalytic Center in San Francisco. He's published widely. He's published on Beyond. He's writes around about typology of analytic fields. He talks about jazz in psychoanalysis, embodied attunement, one of the subjects we take up. And his next work that he's working on, I love the title, it's called Five Uneasy Pieces, Five Psychoanalytic Articles That Changed My Mind. It's I found it to be a very rich and deeply educational experience in reading his work and talking with him, not just cognitively, but as you'll hear in the conversation, something happens if you allow yourself to receive his way of thinking, by no means necessarily to agree with it, but to receive his way of thinking. I personally found to be important and informative, and I hope you get a great deal out of it as well. Here's my conversation with Dr. Henry Markman. Henry, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you here.
Yeah, wonderful to be here.
Henry, we've come up with a title for our conversation today, An Analyst's Journey to Authenticity and Presence. And I'd be hard-pressed to find more challenging notions to flesh out than authenticity and presence. They're so rich and so ambiguous at the same time. But that's our task today. And it's a riff off of your book, which was published this year, called Creative Engagement in Psychoanalytic Practice. And I'd like to do this by first reading a paragraph from the introduction to your book, and then sharing with you some reactions I had when reading the book, and then we'll jump into your thoughts about it. This is from page 2, and you write, "I will focus in this book on the personal and emotional foundation of our work, emphasizing how I and every analyst creatively find, and often struggle to find, distinctive therapeutic ways to relate to and meet each patient. We cannot be neutral. Our patients need us to bring in our full emotional, expressive, and authentic selves to the relationship. Who we are and how we are is an inherent part of the therapeutic process. It can at times be what impedes." Close quote. Now, I think that's a lovely overview of the work, and let me share one person's reaction to reading it, and reading it carefully. In our work, when we're in the analytic setting, we know that we live in two planes with every analysand. We bring our personal selves in the here and now, which consists of our character, our analytic history, our personal history, all of who we are, we bring to the moment. And at the same time, and in tension with, we are a medium for the patient to discover aspects of themselves, present and past, through, for the most part, how they receive who we are. We know that we are more or less consistent over the course of a day, and yet who we are over the course of the day has a great deal to do with who we're with in their eyes. And in reading your book, my initial encounter was to feel that the picture you presented of analytic work was imbalanced, that there was such an emphasis on the here and now, on the personal characteristics of the analyst as the healing object. And I thought it didn't give enough presence and weight to the way the patient receives who we are and how that can be therapeutic in revealing aspects of the patient. So I was unsettled, would be one word, as I read through the book. There's another characteristic of the book, which is that it is rich with clinical examples. They are brief examples and longer examples, and we're going to get to some of them later. And I enjoyed reading them. In accord with what I just said, I didn't always see eye to eye with you, with the way you described it. Nevertheless, something happened to me over the course of reading this book. There was something about how you spoke about your clinical encounters. There was an openness. There was a vulnerability. There was an uncertainty in your mind, sometimes that you shared with the analysand, that something shifted in me, that I wasn't as concerned with whether I thought you had the balance quite correctly, at least as I saw it. But I found myself, to use a word that you use that we're going to discuss, surrendering to the process of receiving your words and ideas and feeling changed in the process of reading the book. I wasn't so concerned with the exactitude of whether you gave sufficient weight to the genetics of the case. But there was something about the openness with which you brought yourself to the writing, which, by the way, is beautifully crafted. There was something about that that led me to receive you and your work and your process in a way that
You know, as patients say, I don't know how I've changed, but I've changed. Well, that was sort of my reaction when reading the book. As I finished it, I said, you know, there's something in what this man is doing that is powerful and that I'm grateful to have immersed myself in. With that as an introduction, talk to us about authenticity and presence as you understand it.
Well, I'd first like to express my appreciation for the seriousness and depth that you encountered my book. And what you're describing in the process of reading is what I'm aspiring to, which is a kind of a deep emotional dialogue, both in the book with the reader, but also in my work with the patient. So I'm more concerned with the experiential nature of our work and what it means to be with someone and the kinds of experiences that follow from a certain way of being with someone than a focus on transference and transference interpretation. Not that I think those aspects of our work are unimportant, but I feel like what is foundational in even making transference interpretations is being tuned into the kind of shared emotional space and process, like you were describing, a kind of dialogue that is enriching and where the person finds something about themselves that they didn't know before. So what that means for me is that I need to find with each person and sometimes in each session a way of being that enlarges their chance of feeling more, knowing more, acting more, experimenting more in the space of the relationship. And that is my aspiration. And in order to do that, the feeling in the relationship, to me, and this is through experience, has to have a quality of realness and what Ferenczi calls sincerity, that the conversation is palpably real. And in order from my side for that conversation to be real, I have to bring my full self into the conversation, which means like what I am able to do creatively, honestly, to meet what I think the patient might need from me in a particular passage of the analysis. So it's true that, let me just say one more thing about that. There's also the idea of mutuality here that is part of a later part of the book where the patient is going to make use of us both in a realistic and transferential way through what's being created between us. So that's still part of my dialogue with them. I don't think that just like I'm bringing my transferences into the relationships, they are too. And that becomes just part of a weaving between us that can be eventually known and articulated. It's not so easy in my experience to separate all these things out, you know, like now this is transference and now
mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other thing is yeah. that in I conceive of the conversation occurring in an intersubjective field so that whatever I'm feeling and bringing is also influenced by what the patient is feeling and way of being. So there is a kind of unconscious joint creation that happens.
You don't mean that, I think, as, for example, a projective identification where what you're feeling is being influenced by something happening in the patient. You sound like you mean something different when you say intersubjective.
Yeah. This is maybe more what Ferenczi calls the dialogue of the unconsciouses, that all the time, at every moment, the patient and I are communicating at an unconscious level and evoking states in each other or communicating states. I don't feel like projective identification, the problem with projective identification is, for me anyway, it puts the analyst in the position of interpreting his or her feelings as evoked by the patient or caused by the patient.
Mm-hmm.
And without a serious contribution of our own to our emotional experience. So I find that is too one-sided of concept for me.
Let me ask you something. In the height of the pandemic, one of the things that our colleagues spoke about was a new sense of symmetry in the office, that we were all in danger, equally so, and that was a change from the usual, quote, asymmetry. Mm-hmm. And if I hear you correctly, that you're making the case for, even without a pandemic, that there's something valuable about emphasizing the symmetry versus the asymmetry. Do I hear you right?
I think so. Well, it depends what you mean by asymmetry. Like, this is where the idea of mutuality comes in.
I think
with the pandemic, it just revealed something that was already there, which is both patient and analyst are known to each other without overtly communicating. Like, I am this person and you are that person. But what is actually picked up between them that is just part of the conversation? The asymmetry part is the where we are in the role of taking care of and helping a person grow with us. But the symmetrical part is that I am in some ways as known to the patient as the patient is known to me. For me, the idea that Racker is getting at about there is not a sick person and a healthy person is that we're, in a sense, both human and we both have our own foibles and constraints. What makes the analytic situation, what makes it asymmetrical is the analyst's intentions, which are different than the patient's, obviously. So the analyst's intentions are to create an experience or allow for or creatively find ways of being with the patient that allow them to develop and grow, face traumas, all sorts of things like that. So in the pandemic, when we all had this experience, I guess, you know, some people just stayed on the phone the whole time and still do. That was, I couldn't do that. I ended up doing a lot of Zoom, and I wrote about that in the last chapter of the book about creative engagement during the pandemic, where like people showed up in ways that I would have never known. Like one person, their house was full of their own artwork that through the analysis, this person totally minimized that activity in their life. And obviously it was a tremendous source of meaning for them. And so I think and you say too about living through harrowing times. There was a period that when in California, we were basically engulfed in smoke.
Yes.
And that was during the pandemic, and also at a time we were approaching the 2020 election. And I can't emphasize too much how on edge me and the patient were, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was palpable. It was palpable.
Sure.
and shared. And I think that this is what Balin talks about too, that the more you can minimize the disparity, the hierarchy in the analytic conversation, the less idealization and the less shame involved in the analysis. And that had we're talking about something that had a very equalizing effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Let me go back to my opening remark, because you just brought up a wonderful issue about idealization, and you brought up one way to understand it and deal with it is by not feeling yourself in the hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the perhaps more familiar way is to understand the early childhood meanings of the need to idealize. Those are different approaches. And what's your sense of the past and how it lives in the analysis and what use you feel there is or isn't in bringing that to the patient's attention in vivo, in real time?
Yeah. I mean, like in terms of like a genetic interpretation?
Well, but I want to avoid the pitfall of it being intellectualized. Okay. I'm talking about the person is experiencing something we're on the same page then. Yeah.
That's a really good question. I think that many of the people I see have suffered, you know, pretty challenging problems in their childhood, and you know, at the level of trauma, I would call trauma at this point. And it was kind of surprising to me once I was open to that dimension of the analysis, that people who, you know, were very high functioning and very adept in certain ways in the world had what Winnicott called the false self. And that underneath that was a very vulnerable person. And that the way that these vulnerabilities were made were through enactments with me of these traumas. So it was the past was lived in the present, often in forms of enactment. With the more severe trauma, it's usually through dissociated enactments that are extremely powerful, and that often I end up contributing to or participating in.
We've all been there.
So in that sense, the past is very alive. You know, the child. But not in the way, not through associations, but through action and shared emotional communication. So I think the past is always there, but it's often, again, through a shared experience. Okay. Yeah.
And the most difficult part in my experience, and certainly not always reached with all patients, of course, but for example, when people have been on the receiving end of various brutalities, physical or emotional, the hardest thing for them to become aware of is that they do to others unknowingly what was done to them. And one of the ways that takes place is in the transference. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me that the way one's presence and authenticity contributes to healing is by our receiving that with all the distress that ensues, and receiving it in service of learning and advancing. That makes sense to you? That fits with your sense of things?
Yeah. I think the idea of presence is just that. It's I got this idea of presence mainly from the work of Gabriel Marcel, who was a French existentialist, who wrote about presence, which he calls availability, or in French disponibilité, which is kind of at the service of someone. He was an ethical philosopher, had a huge impact on me in terms of doing analysis, which is how do we open ourselves up to the experiences that are communicated from the patient that are often really difficult. Mm-hmm. And like you say, like I think Bromberg has written about this, how particularly traumatic dissociations are lived out with the analyst in role reversal. That's right. Just what you said. Very, very hard to take. Yeah. But I think it's crucial that we're able to contain and live with that. Like to viscerally know the patient in that way and be able to contain it. Sometimes we can't, and we'll enact it with them where we're the abuser, for example, the perpetrator. But the therapeutic value of that is enormous in the patient being able to feel that their inner world is really received and contained. And that hasn't been there hasn't been a retaliation or a reaction or a defensiveness on our part, ideally, not, I'm just using this in a kind of ideal way, you know, we're always struggling to allow ourselves to be open in this way.
One of the other aspects of it, I had a conversation with Heinz Weiss from Germany, who works with trauma a great deal. And he had this phrase of, it's like a hot potato where who's guilty? And, you know, it's put on the analyst, and the analyst wants to put it back on the patient, and it's back and forth until hopefully we can talk about it. Speaking of presence, and you have a lovely phrase called embodied presence. Let me read a paragraph from that chapter. You write, quote, "This internal somatic dimension of presence is home port in the tidal seas of analytic interaction, a place from which to attend and act, and under duress, a place to return. Presence is not a perfect Zen-like state. It is more like acceptance, a porousness, and surrender to what is happening that allows us to be with and accompany the patient, especially during the lived experience of challenging episodes in the analysis." Close quote. I just want to mention to those listening that if you are as moved by the beauty of the writing as I am, the book is just filled with that. So it's really a treat. But going back to presence, and we're going to talk about it, how it lives in clinical material that you've included in the book, as I mentioned. Anything more to say about how you get there? Because it's not always present for all of us, of course.
I think for me, once I had this sense of what presence is, like I could find it in myself. And by the way, the idea of presence too was not just from Marcel, but all through my experience as a patient and doing the work and in my training, I could see that there were certain people who communicated what I'm calling presence, though I didn't have a word for it, that was warm welcoming that was palpable. I really could feel that. And it, in my experience, opened me up, like with supervisors. Mm-hmm. And I was just really intrigued with what that is, why that wasn't really discussed as part of analytic work or analytic experience. I tried to cultivate that in my own way. I couldn't be like you know, some of my supervisors and my analysts. I had my own way of finding that in myself. And what I paid attention to and developed are emotional somatosensory indications that I'm open enough. You know, no one's ever fully open, and we're always decentered in some way, but we're like, I could feel my body relaxing. You know, the world around me was more clear. There were brighter colors. The sounds were more distinct. And there was a kind of ease that I felt inside, like I'll just be with whatever is happening. And I started to pay more attention to that and cultivate an awareness of that in myself. And I could also, I'm also very aware when I'm not there, you know, when I'm anxious or agitated or irritated or impatient, and I'm hopefully able to catch that a little bit sooner than maybe in the past, because I have this, I guess, a kind of emotional set point or home port or home base that I'm trying to work from. And also when I communicate to the patient, let's say even if I'm communicating things playfully or difficult, I'm hoping to be in that place when I'm communicating, so it's not as much infiltrated by my own needs and feelings for what the patient should do or be.
Though from what you've said, it sounds like you're open to considering that the degree to which you are or aren't with any particular patient might also be influenced by what the patient knowingly or unknowingly is bringing to the encounter.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, I can be triggered by things in my own past, my own traumas that take a while for me to get a hold of. You know, sometimes the patient will pick it up or notice that I'm enacting something with them, which is very important.
there are many concepts that you spend time on in the book, and we're not going to be able to get to all of them, but I do want to speak about surrender, especially since that captured for me my experience of leaning into your book. You write the following on surrender, quote, "Surrender is the necessary first emotional step. We give up the hard and clear boundaries that separate us from the patient. We give up our sense of control and surety, and we give up our firm sense of identity as analysts and the more rigid habitual ways we know ourselves. Mourning is the actual emotional work of letting go of such attachments that block surrendering." Mm-hmm. Such an interesting word, surrendering, yeah?
I think it's the path to presence. And surrender means letting go of the things that encumber me, protect me, shield me from the encounter, the full emotional encounter with the patient, to be fully involved with the patient. These are ways that that protect me. So I have to give in. I have to give up those those obstacles to presence through a kind of emotional work. And the emotional work is what you just read. Like, I have the things that I want to stay attached to that make me feel firmer in myself and less permeable, more certain, more capable, on top of things, you know, that I've got this kind of feeling, which I know in myself. So, so surrendering means I don't know. I'm going to let myself partake of the experience. Another concept that's helped me a lot is the idea of transitional space. Like, I don't have to know what's going on. It's the meaning of what's happening will emerge rather than me finding it. And I think it's a result of surrender and then giving these things up in the encounter. And this is what I think is generally true for me, is that I'm altered in the process of helping someone. And I sort of think that that's a necessary experience, that my being really affected and altered and changed is really an integral part of therapeutic action. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, so it's only, one might even think of it as an ethical action to work through whatever constraints and encumbrances block my full openness to the patient. And I think that the patient experiences that, you know, when it's there.
You mean something different by surrender than the common phrase that's nowadays being used of reverie. Can you say more about that?
The idea of reverie really started with Bion's notion of alpha function and how unbearable states are contained and transformed symbolically. It's grown. The idea has grown and enlarged to the point where it seems that the analysts, whatever's going on in the analyst's mind is kind of can be the royal road to the patient. And I'm so skeptical of my own inner world and processes as being, you know, true guides, the GPS, as it were, of the patient. So in a sense, I'm actually letting go of my attachment to my own thinking about the patient, or my own maybe overvaluing of my own thoughts that have to do with the patient, and letting the patient maybe even speak for themselves as things emerge between us. I'd rather have it go that way. Hmm. I think it's just become too broad an idea for me to be pragmatically useful. Like, when a concept, when I read certain concepts, all concepts, I'm always trying to filter them through a pragmatic lens. Like, how does this concept, is it actually useful to me in the session?
Mm-hmm.
And some concepts clearly are for me, but some actually might take me away from what I'm trying to do. And I think reverie has, for me, has become that kind of concept.
It's a lovely segue into some clinical material, speaking about operationalizing your thoughts. There are many patients that we could have selected to focus on. We've talked about it, and we've come up with two very different situations. The first is Edward, and we were trying to figure out how best to communicate your experience and Edward's experience with the two of you together. Why don't we start by your introducing Edward to us, and then you can read some of your he said material from the book, and we'll go from there.
Okay. Well, Edward is a clinical example in the chapter on embodied attunement and participation. And it has to do, that chapter, with how we know what's going on in us and in the patient through bodily somatosensory experience. So Edward was somebody who I could feel was dissociated a lot of the time in the session with me. He's very silent for sessions at a time, but he couldn't tell me in words what were going on. But I could feel in the silences a sense of being a floating away of being disoriented and that I was actually living with Edward in this world, in this dissociated world. And I got very anxious when I realized that. So as I started to calm down and could bring myself to a kind of presence and embodied attunement with him of like how tremendously dissociated he was, I tried to speak to him in a way that was not about, oh, you're dissociated or why you're dissociated. I actually tried to bring him into the room with me in an embodied way. Like, for example, I would say to him, well, look at that, or did you hear or see or notice that? Because I wanted to see if we could share a world together. That was my aim. Mm-hmm. And an embodied world. So here's an example of how I tried to do that. After a 10-minute silence in which I experienced the usual physical disorientation, time slows down and it feels much longer than 10 minutes. So I'm lost to myself for 10 minutes, but I gradually find my way back to the physical aspects of a shared world through noting. And what I mean by noting is just putting into words like, I'm feeling dizzy, or I'm feeling light, or I don't know where I am. And that noting for me helped me again bring myself back in an embodied way. So I finally said to him, it's really stormy out there today. Did you get wet coming here? He says, not so bad. Yeah, I like days like this. I guess because it feels good to be inside, you know, a bit cozy, I guess. I said, in here now? I guess so. I like all the wood in your office. It's warm. Here I can feel he's entered. He's entering mm-hmm. the session now. I'm glad you feel that way. He says, do you think a lot about it? I mean, did you mean to make it this way with the wood and the books? And I said, yeah, I was hoping it would be warm and welcoming. It is. Then he gets anxious. And as he's anxious, I'm also starting to feel woozy. Well, and then I try and bring us back again. Well, are there other things you notice here? After a long pause in which I don't know what is happening, but I feel like I'm moving back into the office, he says, this seems crazy. I'm uncomfortable to mention it. But I like your voice. I'm listening to your voice. I think it's calming me down. I was real anxious coming here. And I said to him, and your voice sounds more resonant. Again, this kind of open circle of communication between us, of a certain recognition I want to give him. He says, how did you choose that picture? On the couch, he faces a large abstract painting that's mainly curves and oranges and brown, and the paint is very thickly applied. And he says, I like the color and the movement. I said, the paint is thick, textured-like. Oh, he says, the paint is thick and textured-like. That's cool. Yeah, you like that? What does it do for you? It makes me feel like it's something to touch. I'd like to check it out. I say to him, you can touch it if you like. He says, no, I'm settled here. It's nice lying down and looking around and imagining touching. So just to say a little bit about this, you know, you can see that I'm trying to bring him into the office in a very slow and deliberate way through my voice and what I say, focusing on the world around us to see if we can share something together. I'll just read something at the end here of this section. I say, the concrete world we were speaking about has metaphoric meaning. The office is as a warm, safe haven from the storm, its physicality representing my emotional qualities and body. I feel content to leave our shared exchange in the action of the concrete. That's when a child in play therapy is doing and creating. I prefer to wait for Edward to speak to me when he's ready or interested in a consciously symbolic way, when he needs and wants to. I think he is capable of speaking that way, perhaps, but I'm very content to just be in this transitional play with him as he discovers my body and myself through his experience in the office.
And I understand you to mean by that, that to the degree that he says he would like to touch it, that you're in no rush to verbally address with him the displacement aspects that he would like to touch you.
Right.
And you're comfortable letting that unfold in its own tempo.
Right. I think that the whole sequence is really about his wish in some ways to be inside me and discover me in an embodied way. You know, this was not a typical session in that he and we couldn't turn our attention to the surround in that as much a vivid way as this session. But it did, it had intensely metaphoric quality to it.
Mm-hmm, sure.
You know, like, yeah.
Only because of time, because we could spend a great deal of time on each of these examples, to shift focus to something quite different. The example of Lena, where physicality and presence is lived out in a very different form. Again, the question of how best to communicate that, since it's a longer example, but I think it's an important example. I found it particularly carefully crafted, not to mention analytically astute. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Lena and the enactment that took place and how you dealt with it?
Well, Lena was a graduate student at the time I first met her, and she presented herself as in an extremely professional and polished way, knowledgeable. She said she wanted to be in analysis to deal with personal problems around intimacy. And she was a graduate student in a very intellectual discipline of translation of ancient texts, religious texts, and issues of translation and interpretation. So I was kind of, wow, this is going to be a very interesting experience working with her. But immediately after meeting her, she showed up in a very different way, in a childlike way, She went from a business suit during our first meeting to sweats and t-shirts and a very almost waif-like. But that was interesting and kind of startling. But then as time went on, we entered into a kind of pattern where she would tell me about her work that was interesting. I mean, I was interested in how she thought about her work. But I tended to ignore and was strangely unconcerned with how this transformation that took place in her. And as it evolved, how little of her life existed outside of the analysis. That became more and more clear to me. No friends, very little contact with the world, except occasionally seeing her advisor. And one point I want to make here, and emotionally, is just how kind of sedated and hypnotized I was by this world together. That it was really a feeling that this could go on forever in a timeless way. And I was swept up in it myself. And what drew me a bit out of this symbiotic world with her was a dream she told me in which we were living in apartments, adjacent apartments that shared a wall and with a door, and she could go in and out of that door at will. And that was, you know, clearly what was going on in the analysis. But I still hadn't awoken to the intensity of what was happening in her and with me. And then at one point, a very intense enactment occurred where she was my first patient in the morning, and I saw her in a cottage in the back of my house. I usually go in the morning to get things ready and then go into the house to have breakfast. So I went in the morning early, and I saw in the office somebody crouching with their back to me looking at my bookshelf. I was totally startled and terrified. And she turned around, and it's her. I said, "What are you doing here?" I yelled, "What are you doing here?" in this rage and fear. And she said, "Oh, I was just looking at your books," in this very calm way. And then she fled the office. So waiting.
Quite a moment.
It was a terrifying moment of being invaded. Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, and it's sometimes, at least in my experience, takes these sorts of intense enactments to realize what's actually happening. Because she had told me through the course of our work together that she thought there was something violent and strange in her, and that part of her she had to keep away from other people. She had some relationships with men that were teetered on being violent, you know, in a sadomasochistic way. Again, this was information that I unconsciously and consciously ignored. I was not receiving until she brought home to me what we were actually living through. Hmm. And then I had to just work through all of that trauma in me from that encounter to the point where I could actually be with her and contain her terror of me. And which was very difficult emotionally. I mean, she could see how shaken I was by it, as I could see how terrified she was about what was going to happen next. And all I could do at the beginning was to acknowledge, you know, that something dramatic and frightening had happened between us, and try and stay with her and be with her in that experience. It turned out that I came to understand, just by allowing that experience to develop between us, that her idea of her need for symbiosis had to do with growing up with an alcoholic and physically abusive mother that had never entered our conversation before until after this moment, and which she, for her to exist as a separate person, to be visible and separate and alive, was life-threatening. You know, and she found all kinds of ways of either hiding from her mother, maybe even stealing some of the things that she needed from her mother, like she was stealing from me, or provoking sadistic attacks from her mother. All of this was lived out between us in that moment. One thing I did learn, too, was, and she said this with the most in a guileless way, that she'd been doing this for a long time, that is, coming into my office before the sessions and laying on the couch. And I did have the feeling that her use of me in that way, this was the best use she had of me in her mind, was to be inside me, in my office, in the presence of my office, where she could live. And that was her way of living in the analysis. And the conversations that we had between us were really these dissociated, symbiotic ones.
You're saying the enactment brought it in with more affective aliveness as opposed to the dissociated part of herself. How about if you read one of the paragraphs you wrote about that, and then I want to talk to you about you, more directly about you.
Okay. So I say, I will not go into all the rippling effects of the now moment in the vignette. By the way, this was in a chapter on modes of therapeutic time, where I use this example as of one of a now moment or a transformational moment that arises in our work. So I won't go into all the rippling effects of the now moment in the vignette, and how dramatically the flow of an analytic relationship can change in such a moment. At the core of this shift was a revelation of an emotional truth in her and between us. She slowly grasped her intense need to get inside of and merge with me. In that effort, she could rid herself of a sense of her own separateness and the fear that comes from a separate existence. For Lena, feeling psychically separate meant being in danger of annihilation. She might be seen and attacked. In her mind, the merger with me allowed for a place of safety and protection, something absent in her childhood. I want to say just here that however destructive and seemingly destructive and frightening these dissociative enactments are, they're always progressive because they're bringing in to be experienced something that couldn't be experienced before.
She's trusting you to share it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But not in a conscious way. Something happened that allowed this, yes. But the therapeutic part is that remnants of dissociated traumatic experience are just lived and repeated until there's a point with someone else where they can be experienced rather than dissociated. Mm-hmm. And she experienced her traumas with me in this moment. She believed I would allow for this merged life in the space I provided. Of course, she did not articulate this or be really conscious of it. She just knew it to be true and what she needed. And in that sense, I felt like I had shifted from the trauma in me from that experience to an attuned empathic connection with what she needed from me, but could only have in this surreptitious way.
Henry, let me ask you about you. I mean, this journey you've taken is remarkable. And we all are on our own path of it, not usually as well articulated as you've written. But share with us, who are you? How did you come to find the journey? Never the end point, obviously, but find the journey in the way that you have, and apply it as using psychoanalysis, as you just beautifully described with Lena, as a gift to give to people so that they can create their own journey.
There were certainly influences early on in my life that, and when I think about like presence and how people can be together, that had a big influence on me. One is my father was a pediatrician in LA, and he was like an old time pediatrician because he came from the East Coast. You know, he had this beat up leather bag, and he did house calls, and he and on weekends there would be a steady stream of children coming because you wouldn't see them in their office, you'd see them in our home. I mean, that had a good up and a downside. The downside, yeah, sure, of course, is he wasn't that accessible a lot of the time. But what I did see, he just had a way with children, and especially with babies, that was fascinated me, and with mothers. And so I think that was just in me, you know. I resisted being a doctor for a long time, you know, because of, you know, I didn't want to be like my father. I wanted to have my own existence, my own life. But then the really crucial thing that happened was when I was a late teenager, I was really, really struggling. And probably having to do with what I just said about how to find my own way, my own sense of self. And I found an analyst, a Lofi candidate in LA, and I started working with him, and it was just an amazing experience of a kind of acceptance and space to be myself. I just really felt like there was a kind of birth that happened there, perhaps, you know, from a very, very difficult place that I was in. And I remember things that he said to me, you know, even now. But what was so mysterious to me, like I think you mentioned this earlier, was how better I felt in his presence that lasted. And I just wanted to know what that was. And I also started thinking about what it would be like for me to do that kind of work. At the time, you know, being a psychoanalyst meant being a doctor. And so after college, I studied comparative literature and then went to medical school, really with the idea of becoming a psychoanalyst. And had a lot of experiences, I guess more on my own than in my training and as a resident anyway, and working with teenagers that then became part of my profession, like as a medical director of adolescent programs. And that had a huge impact on how I thought about working with people. And, you know, you can't, you know, fake it with teenagers, you know. And I really loved that. And I loved the idea of like an interactive kind of play. Mm-hmm. I thought that, you know, teenagers play too, you know, they're not like young adults. They're, and then I could extend the idea of play with teenagers to adults. So that gave me a lot of freedom to find ways of being with my patients that weren't necessarily part of my curriculum as a candidate. You know, I was brought up very much in the American eco-psychological tradition, where we didn't read anything outside of that tradition. But I was getting things from just my work, and especially with teenagers, and thinking about what are the real therapeutic factors in our work. I wasn't totally satisfied with the accounts in the literature. I mean, they sounded right, but they didn't feel right in the room with my patients. So then I started reading on, you know, more outside of that tradition. I've I found Bion especially, and then Winnicott, Ferenczi, and others, Balint. It seemed to describe the kinds of transformations I was having with my patients that went beyond concepts and insight more to experiential transformations. So,
which brings us full circle to my introduction to my experience of reading your book. You say that the concepts sounded good, but they didn't feel right in the room. And that's another way to say what I said, which is that there's something about encountering you and your experience of yourself and this work that leaves one feeling changed in all kinds of ways. And I want to share with you how grateful I am for having immersed myself in your book and for you helping me to allow your book to immerse itself in me. It's been a real pleasure. And I'm confident that our listeners will have their own version of that experience in getting to know you better. Mm-hmm. So I want to thank you, Henry. It was really a treat.
I really appreciate what you said. It's very meaningful to me. Thank you. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. We can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.